I have to go upstairs and record something again, so
quiet.
Quiet and do not
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
Hi, you're listening to Pandemic, a new podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Cullum O'Mungoyne, and most days of the week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. The sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat sometimes, as correspondents and I will be recording this, in many cases, on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Wednesday, May 20th, and as we record this episode in the early evening, over 324,000 people have died around the world with COVID-19. Total infections are at over 4.9 million, and that's just the number of cases confirmed through testing. Those numbers come from the Johns Hopkins University Tracker, which uses official data from around the world. At the time of recording, at about 6:30 in the evening, there have been 11 new deaths and 64 new cases in Ireland. Now, later in this episode, we're going to hear from an Irish aid worker on the situation in Yemen, which has experienced years of conflict, outbreaks of disease. It's now seeing its first coronavirus fatalities.
You may already know that Yemen is classified as the worst humanitarian disaster in the world. On every count, Yemen is almost a worst case scenario. It's pretty much a perfect storm. It is the worst possible situation for the virus to spread, and it's a population who are already basically at the end of their resources to resist the virus.
Stay with us for that. And before we get to that item and the situation in hospitals in Ireland and other issues with our health correspondent Fergal Bowers, we're going to turn today to a controversy around a direct provision centre. A cluster of over 20 cases among asylum seekers broke out in the centre. It became the cause of concern among locals and residents of the centre alike. For this episode, let's go first to Pascal Sheehy, our Southern editor, who's been keeping an eye on the story. Why are you in Cathair Sibhín today?
Well, I'm in Cathair Sibhín today because the direct provision centre here is back in the news again, and it has been placed back in the news by the Justice Minister, Charlie Flanagan, who has taken out, unusually, a full-page advertisement in the Kerryman newspaper to write an open letter to the people of Kerry, in which he issues an apology to the people of Cathair Sibhín. Now, he describes his open letter as an apology and an explanation. So maybe we might deal with the apology first of all.
Let's go for that.
He says he accepts that the manner in which the direct provision centre was opened at the former Skellig Star Hotel in the town has caused upset, anger, suspicion and worry, and he says he regrets the extent to which his actions and the actions of his junior minister David Stanton, who has direct responsibility for this area, and the actions of his department contributed to that. But he argues in his favour, I suppose you could say, that it had to be this way, that in early March his officials realised that they needed new centres quickly, and because it was not tenable in a health emergency to have large numbers of applicants for asylum in emergency hotel accommodation around Dublin. And so the Skellig Star Hotel had been identified in a previous expression of interest, and they moved on it very, very quickly. Charlie Flanagan says it was fast. I admit that. It left little or no time for engagement. I admit that. It was presented as a fait accompli. I admit that too. All I can say in my department's defence is we simply did not feel we had a choice. We were facing an unprecedented health emergency, and the Skellig Star was available to us.
Now, and in case anybody wasn't reading the Kerryman, Pascal, he also took to the air earlier to speak to Sarah McInerney on RT1's Today programme. Let's hear a bit of that.
Can you tell us why you have apologised to the people of Kerry this morning?
Because I was unhappy at relations between the people of Cathair Sibhín and those in the direct provision centre, and also the efforts that myself and Minister David Stanton have been making have been made in the context of an unprecedented pandemic. And it meant, for example, that we weren't able to consult face-to-face in the way we would have liked.
OK, and have you apologised to the residents, or how do you plan to do that?
I do so now through you. I'm in contact with my officials.
If they're not reading the Kerry Man, or if they're not reading the papers in Kerry as you believe, are they likely to be listening to RT Radio 1?
I don't believe the Kerry Man is a high seller in the Skellig Hotel. I don't say that flippantly, but the purpose of my letter, Sarah, was to address the people of Kerry, and I didn't deem it appropriate for me to communicate in this manner with the people who are directly under my care and the people who I work with on a daily basis.
All right, so how will you communicate with them, though? Would you go and speak to them in person?
No, one of the difficulties about the COVID, and this is something, again, that I discussed some weeks ago with Minister Stanton, there was a difficulty or a challenge in actually going to Cairns have been having a face-to-face meeting with communities, having face-to-face meetings in the centre because of the COVID, because I'm subject to the same restrictions as everybody else. Mm. But during the outbreak, we have always sought at official level and indeed at ministerial level to make life as comfortable as possible for the residents there, right, and to address any of their concerns which are brought to our attention on a daily basis, and we'll continue to do that.
All right.
In the first instance, any newspaper getting a full-page ad is going to welcome a full-page ad. But in terms of local reaction to this, has it been welcomed?
Well, first of all, can I tell you that it has, nothing else has been talked about here in Cathair Sibhín today, I would venture. It is front-page news in the Kerryman, in addition to the full-page advertisement inside. It is the topic of conversation. And while I think in general many people will welcome the apology, although it comes 2 months into this controversy, most people would say, and most people certainly that I have spoken to, would say that it doesn't address their central point, which is the calls by local people, the calls by residents in the centre, and indeed the calls of 30 academics and lawyers and civil rights activists on Charlie Flanagan to shut this centre down on the basis that it is not suitable. Bear in mind that when this centre was opened on March 18th, local people welcomed the arrival of asylum seekers into the town. The town has a declining population, but it was when there was confirmation of coronavirus cases here, and when those cases were not communicated directly and promptly to the people of the town, that I think trust was damaged at that stage in the relationship between the Department of Justice and local people.
And we're going to hear from a couple of local people just in a moment, Bascal, and you can introduce them in just a second. But taking out a full-page ad, Bascal, what led to the crisis point that prompted action now, 2 months later from, as you say, when these people were first welcomed to the town by the local people of Cathair Sibhín?
I can't say what led to the action now, but this has been building and building and building. And perhaps it just got to a critical point where Minister Charlie Flanagan felt he had to act. Perhaps it is also the case that it has taken him some time to get to the bottom of issues involved. I suppose we hear calls constantly on ministers to investigate things. You would prefer that people would investigate things and comment then, rather than commenting on from the top of the head. And perhaps it is the case that it took this length of time for Charlie Flanagan to amass the facts in this case and then respond as he has done so, and in quite some detail as well. In addition to the apology which Charlie Flanagan has issued, he also, to the disappointment of local people and the disappointment of residents, he has also rejected within this apology their calls for closure of the centre. He says there is a contractual obligation in place that is operating and it will continue to do so. So first off, I spoke to Jack Fitzpatrick. He is chairman of the Community and Business Alliance in Cathair Sibhín, and I think we can hear afterwards then from Lisa O'Shea, who is PRO of the Tidy Towns Committee, but more importantly in this instance, she is a member of the Fáilte Cathair Sibhín Committee, which was formed to welcome asylum seekers to the town. First, Jack Fitzpatrick.
Well, my reaction is that it's not an apology we need right now. What we need, Pascal, is a solution to the situation that we have here in Cathair Sibhín. And there is only one solution. The building is not fit for purpose. The corridors are narrow. The lifts are small. It's a congested, very congested area. and there's 54 bedrooms, small little bedrooms there. And he's talking about that it has capacity for 150 people. It has not capacity for 150 people. These people need to be taken to some place where it's suitable for them.
Okay, I'm Lisa O'Shea. I'm born and bred in Carseveen, and I'm involved in Carseveen Tidy Towns, the Carseveen Alliance, and the Carseveen Falta group that we set up to help welcome the residents to Carseveen. And with regards to the apology this morning, I think it's a little bit too little too late. It's not good enough. I don't think moving anybody during a pandemic was in any way responsible, never mind moving them from an epicentre in Dublin to one of the furthest points away in South Kerry to Carseveen, where there was no DP centre previous to this. It wasn't ready, it wasn't fit for it, and it's not fit for a DP centre regardless of COVID.
All right, so that's some of the local reaction you got, Pascal, but you've also been speaking to a resident of the Skellig Star Hotel. Now, are residents on the same page as the local people with regard to wanting something done about the accommodation, or even going as far as wanting the facility closed?
Yes, they are, and they have been. There were initially more than 100 people moved to the Skellig Star Hotel. It's a boutique hotel of around 56 bedrooms. That number has been reduced because, first of all, there are around 20 cases of corona, or there have been around 20 cases of coronavirus confirmed in the hotel, most of those among residents. And as residents were confirmed, they were moved to separate recuperation and treatment facilities. So the population at the Direct Provision Centre has reduced that way, and it is now down to around 70 people. Aswar Fuard is a business consultant who came here from Sri Lanka with his wife and three-year-old daughter in May of last year. He is also a spokesperson for the residence group, and he gave me his reaction to Charlie Flanagan's apology.
The move was not properly done. Due to the advice from HSE, we were moved from there. But we were put from different hotels, put to a small hotel here, where we couldn't follow the social distancing and the real measures. So we know the virus has spread in the building, and it's spread to many people here. So we say, like, not only like with that, they have to further go and they have to take some action for this immediately, to move the people from here to a safer place.
Charlie Flanagan, finally, earlier in an interview, a lengthy interview with Sarah McInerney on the Today programme on RTE1, said anyone who wants a single accommodation can get single accommodation, in answer to a question that could have been asked on blind date.
Would you have shared a bedroom with the stranger, Minister, at the height of the pandemic?
I would regard that as very challenging, and that's why in Caherseveen, any single person who has a desire to have a room on their own has one.
He said that situation has been resolved, that mitigation measures have been taken, and that many of the problems that existed with this facility at first no longer exist. What's the feeling you got on the ground? Are people in any way reassured by this, or is this a controversy that's likely to keep running?
There's certainly life left in this controversy, and it will run for some time. But ultimately, the decision on the future of this centre may not come down to Charlie Flanagan. It may not come down to the residents, and it may not come down to the local people here. I spoke this afternoon to a Killarney-based solicitor, Padraig O'Connell. He has confirmed that he has been instructed to draft papers seeking an injunction against the continued operation of the Direct Provision Centre, and he will be challenging its continual use as a Direct Provision Centre based on the current planning in force at the centre. Now, that remains to be seen. That case remains to be argued out in court. But certainly, Padraig O'Connell confirming this afternoon that he has been instructed to draft proceedings seeking an injunction to have the centre closed down.
Pascal, I suspect we'll be talking again about this.
Thank you, Colin.
Shortly, we're going to hear from Fergal Barris, as I said at the start, about what's going on here in Ireland. But first, let's go to Rhianna Judge McCormack, who works with the Norwegian Refugee Council in Yemen. The country has been suffering the consequences of civil war since 2015, and that conflict has seen regional actors like Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates and Iran fan the flames and indeed take a direct role in some cases. The country was sadly no stranger to war before that. Civilians have seen disease outbreaks, sieges, food shortages. And Rihanna, who's in Dublin at the moment but normally based in Yemen, has been telling me about how the country stands almost completely unprepared for COVID-19 as it sees the virus's first casualties. So Rihanna, you're in Dublin at the moment, but you normally work in Yemen. So tell us a bit about your work, first of all, and how it is you find yourself back in Dublin.
Well, actually, I've only recently begun with the Norwegian Refugee Council in Yemen, but I was previously based in Iraq and Syria. So I have a lot of experience on the ground in complex situations with aid work. The Norwegian Refugee Council focuses particularly on anyone who has been forced to flee. That's both people who might have to move within their own country or go across international borders and become refugees. And we focus our efforts on wherever needs are greatest. So at the moment, we work across 31 countries, and Yemen is our largest aid program. You may already know that Yemen is classified as the worst humanitarian disaster in the world. On every count, Yemen is almost a worst case scenario. We have 5 years of conflict that the country is embroiled in, and the conflict is still ongoing. This means that you have 10 million people on the brink of famine as a result of the conflict and the economic war that has accompanied that. You have half of all healthcare facilities in the country not fully operational. You have 80% of the population dependent on humanitarian aid. And I think one of the most startling figures of all is the 3.5 million people who have been displaced from their homes. So that means they are living in camps, they are living crowded into public buildings in the worst possible situation that you can imagine. If you can picture all of that and then the threat of COVID coming in on top of it, it's pretty much a perfect storm. It is the worst possible situation for the virus to spread, and it's a population who are already basically at the end of their resources to resist the virus.
And what do you mean when you say near famine situation? What does that look like in terms of malnutrition and disease and the health knock-on effects?
It's catastrophic, essentially. So it's the WHO who classifies 10 million people as being one step away from famine. That means that they are struggling every day to get enough food, and that they are highly dependent on food aid that comes through organizations like the United Nations and the Norwegian Refugee Council. And I'll give you just a picture of what that looks like. We spoke last week to the Mahyoub family, who were goat farmers until they were forced to flee. And they were actually, they fled the same day the first COVID case was confirmed in Yemen, the 10th of April. And they are now living in the middle of the desert. It was the only safe place they could find. And this is essentially a patch of bare land where there are now 500 families living in this patch of land. So they don't have running water, they don't have any food source, they don't have sanitation, the very basic necessities of life, never mind being able to put in place procedures to prevent the spread of COVID, are simply not there. And that's why the aid operation is so essential in Yemen.
And what diseases were already on the ground? Because we did hear about cholera and a number of other diseases, communicable diseases, that had broken out in Yemen or during the course of the war and have been there, present there for years.
Absolutely. Yemen, before all of this, has been battling the worst outbreak of cholera in recorded human history. Just since the beginning of the year, there have been over 130,000 suspected cases of cholera. Malnutrition is absolutely rife. In some ways, this means that COVID, as I said, is more likely to spread, is more likely to have a catastrophic impact. In other ways, it does mean that the aid organization like ourselves are in some ways equipped to try and put in place procedures for this, because the same kinds of efforts we've been making to try and limit the impact of cholera or dengue can be applied to the COVID response. So that's about providing clean water, providing soap, helping people understand what they must do to prevent transmission, building latrines, trying to ensure that people have enough space to self-isolate at home. But for all of the reasons that I've outlined, this is obviously a very difficult endeavour.
Now, just checking up on the latest statistics today, there are, I think, 167 confirmed cases in Yemen as we record this around midday on Wednesday. 5 people have recovered and there have been 28 deaths. And given the presence of it, and it would seem obviously the spreading presence of it within the community, how has that impacted on aid organisations and their decisions to deploy? I know you're saying that an aid effort is underway, but how hampered is that by COVID-19?
It's a really good question, and it's one we've been grappling with since before the first case was confirmed, because we knew that this was coming. So for the Norwegian Refugee Council, despite both the restrictions from the authorities and the safety measures that we have decided to take for our staff and the communities we serve, we are managing to continue most of our critical life-saving operations. We have scaled down some non-critical activities, largely our education program and other trainings in the community. And we are facing a suspension of flights in and out of the country. Now, there have been some flights bringing humanitarian workers out and in, but that will have an impact on operations. But mostly what we've been doing, we have 257 national staff inside the country, and we've been continuing our programs that distribute food, cash to buy food, water, water trucking, clean water, maintenance of water systems, and sanitation support. And at the same time, what we've been doing is scaling up prevention and mitigation activities. So this is both providing communities with extra supplies. So, for example, in the last 2 months, we've given out more than 300,000 bars of soap, because just to give you a very clear picture of the kind of situation, 75% of families report that they couldn't afford soap, or they didn't have access to soap. And we are also helping to support the usual municipal cleaners to continue their sanitation efforts. And we are ensuring in all the work that we do that our staff have protective equipment, that there is, for example, social distancing in queues for distributions of food or soap or other materials, and that there are hand washing stations installed wherever we work.
And just, you mentioned there that you distribute cash so people can buy food. Food prices in a conflict situation inevitably go higher. What kind of a challenge is it with COVID added into the mix on supply chains and everything else? What are the implications in terms of the buying power when it comes to food?
This is such an essential question, because this is, again, on top of everything else people are facing. We've been monitoring, along with other organizations, food prices, the exchange rate, and we're seeing food, especially essential food items and soap, the prices are soaring already. What we have to remember is Yemen is only just on its way into this curve now. A lot of countries that we're looking at around the world have already hit the top of the curve, or maybe even coming out of it. Yemen is just at the beginning of the spread of the virus. So we are already seeing these extremely worrying signs. The minimum food basket that the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization tracks the cost of has already jumped in some places by 20%. And it's extremely concerning as well, because there is a supply issue in Yemen. Yemen, even before the war, imported most of its basic food commodities. Combined with the war and the restrictions and the sanctions that have been put in place, there is now, according to the World Food Organization, a four-month pipeline delay for getting food into the country. This is even not taking into account additional restrictions imposed by COVID. This was ordinarily what was in place. So you're looking at a catastrophic situation if urgent action isn't taken.
In the immediate term, what kind of solutions are being looked at? Because it sounds quite a pile of problems to sort through. So what are the first things that would need to be tackled in the immediate term to alleviate some of what you're dealing with?
The very first thing is an immediate, nationwide, effective ceasefire. We welcome the unilateral ceasefire that was declared by Saudi Arabia more than a month ago, but this is not filtering down on the ground. I'll give you one example. That's the Ibrahim family that we spoke to. They were farm laborers, and they fled their homes only 2 weeks ago because of the fighting. And they're now living crowded into another family's tent. They don't even have their own temporary shelter. They're living with a family who had fled 3 years ago and still can't return to their homes. This is not a situation where it's possible to fight the spread of COVID. So we absolutely need this ceasefire to stop the minimum of 1,500 people we're tracking who are fleeing every week still in the middle of this.
I'm sorry, when you say a ceasefire, you say the Saudis have declared a ceasefire and that hasn't trickled down, but there's the added complicating factor now, the United Arab Emirates backing a separatist effort as well. So how much complexity has that thrown into the conflict in terms of trying to achieve a ceasefire?
The situation in the southern area with the Southern Transitional Council has actually existed for quite a while. There was previously very high level of conflict and battles in Aden, the southern port city, last year. So this is a resurgence of that issue. It does make it very complicated. And also on the ground, this is not just a conflict that has international involvement, but it's also a conflict that is very local, and there's a lot of actors on the ground. So this is why the process that the United Nations has been leading to try and agree a comprehensive ceasefire on the ground is so essential. And this is the first step, as we said, in hoping to be able able to contain this. The second is that we have to make sure that any restrictions put in place to fight COVID doesn't block access to life-saving aid. Yemen is in some ways a unique case because aid is actually a lifeline. There are serious concerns that actually the impact, the economic impact or the impact of cutting off aid could be worse than the impact of the virus itself. So again, once the ceasefire is declared, warring parties must ensure that food, fuel and medicines can continue to enter Yemen and that aid organizations can do their job across the country. And the third thing is that we are asking for the international community to stand in solidarity with Yemen. And this is really the time to scale up aid to this country, not scaling back. We're seeing millions of Yemenis who are already weakened by hunger and disease, who are going to be mostly defenseless before this virus. There is a major pledging conference coming up in a couple of weeks, and we are really hoping to see the $2 billion gap that the United Nations says still exists in trying to respond to the Yemen crisis this year, because we absolutely cannot walk away from these vulnerable people at the time that they need this help the most.
Finally then, Reena, a country like Ireland can provide widespread social supports during the time of the lockdown and until the restrictions are eased and people begin to go back to work again. More vulnerable countries can't go into lockdown and provide those kind of social supports. So what are the mitigation measures that a country like Yemen can take against COVID when the writ of the central authority doesn't run in all parts of the country? The economic life that's there can't simply be locked down and supports be provided in its absence.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really good question. And it's further complicated in Yemen by the fact that many civil servants, and that includes teachers, doctors, nurses, have actually not been paid in years as a result of the conflict. So a lot of them have been supported by stipends coming from the United Nations and aid agencies. And that's now under threat because of the funding crisis. And so all of this underlines the essential role that aid organizations play in Yemen in cooperation with local authorities at all levels. And there are some very innovative responses coming out from the ground. My education colleagues are working with different education authorities to look at how we could start to actually roll out some education activities online in other countries. Like in our program in Liberia, this is happening with teachers running virtual classrooms over WhatsApp with their students. We are seeing for our protection programs that advice is being provided by phone at scale. So there are innovative ways to do this if we have the access and we have the funding to do so.
All right, Reena, thanks very much. When are you due back in Yemen? Do you know, is there a time frame for your return to the country?
Yes, it's a little uncertain at the moment because even though the flights are now up and running, the next step is the visa process. But we're hoping that those essential staff who are outside of the country at the moment can get back in within a month to 2 months.
All right, listen, thanks a million for the chat.
It's a problem at all. Thanks, Colin.
And finally today, we're going to get an update from our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers, on some of the trends in Ireland's outbreak. Fergal, 2 hours. We heard the Oireachtas COVID committee yesterday. They broke it up into 2-hour session, but this has become somewhat of a golden rule in other areas. What are the origins of it and what's the basis for it?
Well, the Oireachtas sought advice in terms of holding the special committee meetings on the COVID-19 response. And its advice that it secured was that a group shouldn't be together for more than 2 hours in any 24-hour period. So that's why the committee breaks up after 2 hours. And indeed, the same members, if they've been there for 2 hours, don't come together for a further 2 hours. Now, that's the health and safety advice they got. The chief medical officer has said he wasn't a party to that advice to the Oireachtas. They do have a business advisor, and clearly that advice was sought and they secured it. I think they're looking for some clarification on it. The matter was raised yesterday evening by journalists at the Department of Health's briefing. We were told that overall advice hasn't changed. The primary advice is anyone who spends 15 minutes or more within 2 meters of a person would be regarded as a close contact if that other person was found to have confirmed COVID-19. But that the advice at the Health Protection Surveillance Centre, the general advice is regarding not spending, two people shouldn't spend more than 2 hours together in a 24-hour period.
Right.
But the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Hoolan, did say that shouldn't be interpreted as a hard and fast rule.
We saw our colleague Orla O'Donnell reporting earlier that the courts had issued a notice saying that clarification had been sought as to whether or not they could sit for more than 2 hours, and saying they wouldn't be sitting for more than 2 hours. So the two-hour figure has become a hard and fast rule in the Oireachtas and in the courts, it seems.
Yes, and indeed other employers are scratching their heads saying, is this a rule we need to enforce? Because if that was to be a hard and fast rule that employers have to adhere to, it'll certainly change the workplace for everybody, all of us. Now, the point was made yesterday by the Chief Medical Officer that a lot would depend on the size of the room, the ventilation, the nature of the work that's been done, and that in particular this two-hour so-called rule, it's really more to do with the circumstances that would trigger a risk assessment and a basis for deciding who was a close contact of a confirmed case or not. So look, there isn't total clarity about it. It will be raised at tonight's briefing, and especially given that the courts have now decided they're going to adhere to it pending further advice.
Well, let's hope it doesn't push tonight's briefing over the two-hour mark. Anyway, Fergal, to the issue of hospitals, today's update on the number of people in hospitals, how is the trend with regard to the occupation of hospital beds in acute hospitals with COVID cases?
It's very much, Colm, as I was saying earlier in the week, so all week it has, I think you could say, stabilised. There are 649 patients with confirmed or suspected COVID-19 in hospitals now, 72 patients in intensive care units with either confirmed or suspected COVID-19. There's 132 vacant critical care beds in hospitals. So, you know, it continues to be able to cope with the current pressures, and it has some wriggle room, obviously, in terms of if there were to be, you know, an additional surge of admissions, it could deal with that. But overall, the hospital system, it has to ramp up to start dealing now again with non-COVID-19 cases and cutting waiting lists. And that's going to be a big challenge because, as we heard yesterday, for as long as COVID-19 is here, medical procedures are going to take longer, they're going to cost more, there'll be fewer performed for safety reasons, as health staff have to don and then take off the various protective materials. And then you can't have large groups of patients waiting in adjacent areas because of the infection risks.
Fergal, another issue that has come up, and we had a long chat with Fran McNulty, our colleague, the Agriculture and Consumer Affairs correspondent, last week, and we touched on it yesterday as well, the issue of meat processing plants. And a representative from Meat Industry Ireland was speaking on Morning Ireland earlier today, talking about how there had been clusters and outbreaks in meat processing plants. He was saying it was in a minority of cases. They were doing all that they could, but it still remains to be an area of concern.
Yes, I mean, there have been 828 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the meat industry, and 328 more cases compared to last week. So it is a problem. Now, the meat industry has said it's doing all it can to deal with outbreaks in meat plants. There have been 16 clusters to date in meat plants, and the industry says that many sites operated by its members remain unaffected. That is true. It's very important because overall, most of the confirmed cases of COVID-19, they're now really in things or workplaces like the meat sector, but they're not in the general population. So what can we say now? Well, we can certainly say that COVID-19 is not spreading in the community out there, in the general community in Ireland. And that's a very significant point. If you were to factor out the reduced issues that are happening in nursing homes and those problems in the meat, in certain meat plants, coronavirus is not a problem in the community. So I suppose people will start saying, well, if that's the case, why are we still in, you know, virtual lockdown, as it were? And that is going to add to pressure to, if the positive trends continue, to bring forward the relaxation of certain measures.
And in tandem with all of that, I think the testing capacity was up. It's up at 15,000, but there were 4,000 tests per day being conducted last week. The figures now are 6,000 tests per day, so still some spare capacity there, but there is active testing going on. Do we have any idea where that's been targeted, what accounts for that extra 2,000 on last week, or is that general members of the public coming forward and seeking testing, given the widening of the criteria for testing?
So the testing criteria was widened in relation to close contacts and the period of time that you'd want to test people. And also then, I think on Friday, the National Public Health Emergency Team will consider that issue about a loss of taste or smell. I think the expectation is that will be officially added to the list of symptoms. So, yes, testing capacity at the moment, we're told it's 15,000 a day, can be done. They're doing about 6,000 between community laboratory tests a day. And swab testing results, there's a new daily metric now being published by the HSE, along with those other hospital figures I was giving you earlier. And what they tell us is that averaged over 7 days, the time taken for a swab to be taken to the laboratory results overall is 1.6 days. So, I mean, that's a good metric. That shows that the period of time between testing and results has tightened. But then you do need to bear in mind that that's based on about, you know, 6,000, well, initially 4,000, but 6,000 a day now. What would happen if you're actually doing 15,000 or more tests a day? Could those metrics, could that timescale be held? And we will watch for that if the figure was to increase. And then, you know, even though the average might be 1.6 days, there are still cases where individuals are waiting much longer as we hear about them. But the number of cases seems to be reducing. Well, purely anecdotally, in terms of communications that I'm getting, they're nothing like the level that there was a few weeks ago in terms of very long delays.
It still seems to be very much on the side of playing it safe, though, finally, Fergal. There are 3 weeks being left between all of the phases so that any change in the infection rate could be monitored and the increased testing and contact tracing capacity be brought to bear on any clusters that might break out in the time between the relaxation of phases, if indeed they do end up being relaxed according to the current sequence and plan.
I mean, that's true. Dr. Tony O'Hoolan last night did say he was, you know, I think hopeful and optimistic that we would be able to move to phase two and phase three. So that's even at this stage early on, given the trends, that is encouraging.
That's not like, you know, him. He's normally fairly cautious.
He did emphasize yesterday also at the COVID-19, the committee hearing, that, you know, this is public health advice, but the government does have to look at the wider picture always along with the public health advice. And that wider picture has to be about society and about business. And going back to a point, I think, you know, that was made many weeks ago, there has to be a country to reopen. Public health advice is crucial and you need to save as many lives as possible. There's a balance there, though, overall balance to be got by government, that if restrictions stay in place for too long, such as to strangle the economy, the country's in a very dire place economically for years to come. So it's a very challenging decision. You would think at this stage, if the trends continue, that there will be significant pressure to pull forward the opening of, you know, more stores, more places. I think a point that Fran McNulty was making during the week, seeing as to date, people seem to have adhered to their ground rules and there haven't been any major problems reported.
Okay. All right. Look, thanks very much, Fergal.
Take care of yourself.
And that's all for this episode of Pandemic. We're back tomorrow with more. In the meantime, do get in contact with suggestions or questions by email to colm.omongain@rte.ie. That's colm.omongain@rte.ie. Or on Twitter at @ColumOmongain. Do subscribe through your usual podcast platform to get this podcast regularly. Reviews are welcome. And of course, nice reviews even more welcome. So until tomorrow, take care. See you.